I was thinking naming this talk "The Buddha Wasn't Buddhist," but that's kind of negative and it has a negation in it, so I kind of don't like it. So I won't call it like that. So forget that I said that. I think a better title could be "Holding Beliefs Lightly." And I like to start with a quote by the Dalai Lama that I read some time ago that says, "Don't try to use what you learn from Buddhism to be a Buddhist. Use it to be a better whatever you already are. Don't try to use what you learn from Buddhism to be a Buddhist. Use it to be a better whatever you already are." And reflecting about beliefs or identities or things that we attach to the self to give us support, I looked at the way the Buddha in the Pali Canon, which are the older scriptures in Buddhism, how he talked about clinging, because he many times he said that clinging is the source of suffering. So when he talked about clinging, he mentioned the kinds of clinging that we are more aware of, which is clinging to pleasurable objects. But besides pleasurable objects, he mentioned other sources of clinging. And among them were other three. One is attachment to or clinging to rituals and ritualism. Another one is attachment to self, to a sense of separate self. And the other one is attachment to opinions and views. And I think that is really interesting. At least in my experience, when I think about attachment, I think about things that I like and people that I love. But in a more invisible level, opinions as source of clinging or views or set of beliefs are a huge source of suffering, especially interpersonally, but also even on national scale. Countries would kill for certain beliefs. Religions would kill for certain beliefs. If the other doesn't agree with my belief and I feel threatened, I will even go to the extent of annihilating them. So views, perspectives, and sets of beliefs seem to be kind of an important thing to pay attention to. Especially being in a Zen center or in a Buddhist center, where I feel, in my experience, I feel tempted to assume the identity of a Buddhist, forgetting that the word Buddhist or Buddhism was first used in 1801 for the first time. The Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. The Buddha was awakened. The name Buddha comes from Bud, which means to awaken. So he just practiced awakening and taught awakening to others. But we were discussing with one resident the other day, like, wow, we have all these problems and we're in a spiritual community. Well, precisely. And that can be part of the problem. Because we get the identity of I'm a spiritual practitioner or we are in a spiritual community, very important stuff can remain in the shadow, in the unconscious, in the unnamed, in the unseen, in the invisible. And this has brought a lot of suffering in spiritual communities. So the Buddha said once, "My teaching is not a philosophy, it's the result of direct experience. My teaching is a means of practice not something to hold on to or worship. My teaching is like a raft used to cross a river. Only a fool would carry the raft around after he had already reached the other shore of liberation. So he was very, very precise about this. And also another passage from the suttas, from the Pali Canon, the Buddha says, "O monks and wise men," I guess there were not many women around in those days, "just as a goldsmith would test his gold by burning, cutting, and rubbing it, so must you examine my words and accept them, not merely out of reverence to me." So he wasn't only saying, be careful about clinging to beliefs, but be even careful to what you projecting on my, on these teachings. When he was proposed to standardize all his teachings, put it in a in one language that would never change, he said, "No, don't do that. That would be a total mistake. Each different community with different language should have a particular understanding of the teachings." But we as human have the tendency to look for monolithic visions of things, to project them out as a solid stuff that is good, and then to take it in as part of my identity. I'm a Buddhist, for instance. And it's tricky because we often think we are liberated from ideologies, but they're very sneaky. They can have funny ways in hiding, and especially probably is the case with most of you, but in my case I was raised Catholic in Chile, and what I've seen in myself and in other, you know, in other people that go to embrace a foreign tradition, an Eastern tradition coming from a Western context, many times the most superficial layers of oneself change. I would shave my head, I would shave for years, or would use a lot of dark stuff, or I would, I don't know, bow every time I was going to say something, or stuff like that. But sometimes underneath those changes, there are underlying beliefs that makes me relate to these new teachings with old habits. Actually, the fact that we use the word Buddhism and we have to use some word, it's the way that the West grasped the Dharma and turning into something similar to what we knew as a religion, you know, to have a someone to revere, to worship, to have a set of beliefs that were written in the sutras, and then practice that. So believing in God or in the Virgin or believing in emptiness is not so different if it's we remain in the level of believing and taking things, new beliefs, to dress our identity and to give us a sense of security. It is said that Zen Master Rinzai lived in a temple with 1,000 Buddha sculptures made out of stone. So when a disciple came to him and wanted to study with him, he asked, "Why do you want to study with me?" And people would sometimes respond, "Because I want to be like Gautama the Buddha." And Rinzai would say, "Yo, go away. We have enough Buddhas here. I have 1,000 Buddhas in the temple already. We don't need another Buddha." And of course, inside, love the Buddha and the Buddha's teachings. But I think he was pointing to that trap that we tend to fall, which is trying to be a Buddha. Trying to be a Buddha. Instead of trying to be ourselves and trusting that there is what we call a Buddha nature, but each one manifests in a different way. Similarly, some years ago, about 12 years ago, I was in a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh in Plum Village. And something that stayed with me from that retreat was that once we were practicing walking meditation, and of course when Thay is there, he has a big presence, and we all want to be good students. You know? He's a very revered teacher that we all love very much. So we were trying our best to do good walking meditation. And he said once, don't try to be a Buddha. Be a Buddha. What does that mean? It was like a koan. Two. And one of the things that I thought about that is that trying, in a way, is postponing. It's postponing our encounter with whatever it is or reality in this very moment, which is where the Buddha was pointing to. So when I try to be a Buddha, I have a mental image of how that looks like, how it stands, how it sits, how it talks, how all these externalities, and I try to bring them in and appropriate and build my identity on that basis. And the funny thing, at least in my experience, is that I came to Buddhism a while ago while trying to find a honest way to face uncertainty. And many other people have that experience, that they come to spiritual practice when they experience the groundlessness of life, that all of a sudden the loved one dies, or we get a diagnosis that is terminal, or other things happen. We lose our job where we had a huge amount of our identity put on that, and to explore that opening, I felt that Buddhism was amazing. The practice of Buddhism was amazing. But then after a while, I noticed that things got settled, and I adopted the identity of a Buddhist to have a new ground, some certainty and attachment to that. And then I can easily start having views of what is right and what is wrong from a Buddhist point of view, and then only not from myself, but imposing to others. Is this any familiar to you? We get a comfort of security, a sense of identity. And it's very human, really. It's not, but we're funny like that, no? Because not only with Buddhism, it's just with anything. We find there is a good way to, I don't know, to clean a kitchen, and then we get really mad if others don't do it that way, for instance. Or how to garden, or how to, I don't know. There's so many things. Living with others is a joy like that. So, one way to go about this koan of not trying to be a Buddha, but being a Buddha, which for me means practice awakening. That's what I'm trying to do when I really practice. I practice awakening. Is to blur the distinction between practice and non-practice. when I feel I have a fixed idea of what Buddhism is, what automatically happens is that that gets reduced to one area of my life. Maybe Sunday mornings. Maybe the half an hour sit. And then the other things that happen throughout the day are not really informed by this intention of awakening and the attitude of compassion. And the thing is that we're always practicing something. That's a funny thing, is that we cannot not practice something. I mean, when I'm angry, I'm practicing anger. And getting angry is going to be easier the next time, because my brain learns to do that. When I'm anxious, I'm practicing anxiety, and that is a more accessible emotion the next time. When I practice patience, it gets more ingrained as a habit, and so on. When I practice wisdom, concentration, effort, generosity, and so on. Can you let me in? Shall I take one question from here?
Yeah, we can hear.
Yeah?
One minute. How many do we have?
12 people.
Is there one Christian left?
There's a Christian right here.
Oh, great.
Yes, enough?
Yes, enough.
It's two. Welcome. No worries. Welcome. So I was saying that we cannot escape the fact that we're always practicing habits of the mind and habits of the heart. In Buddhist psychology, these are called seeds or bijas that we water through actions from our mind, our speech, and body. And I talk a little bit about this when we talk about mind gardening about a month ago, that we're always watering some seeds and neglecting others. And some interesting studies in neuroscience have discovered that we have about 50,000 thoughts a day. Some other studies say that we have more, some other less, but probably in the order of tens of thousands of thoughts. And most of the thoughts are just reinforming what we already know, and the mind tends to be rehearsing and rehashing all the time. So, the world that we end up perceiving is built on the habits that we create on the mind. So, someone that sees the world as a dangerous place, which is very common these days, people are afraid. Start seeing people as potential aggressors or enemies. Some other people end up seeing the world as a marketplace, and they see others as clients or competitors in my business. Some others see the world as amusement park and see others as objects of entertainment, and so on. So we have an active participation in the kind of world that we create. And this is done not in the cushion, but it's done every day and every night, 24 hours a day, because even when we're dreaming, the habits of the mind are being reinforced. Sharon Salzberg said, we learn and grow and are transformed not so much by what we do, but by why and how we do it. I will read that again. We learn and grow and are transformed not so much by what we do, but by why and how we do it. So I guess maybe Rinzai was pointing to that fact when he said, just by sitting like a Buddha, you won't become a Buddha. You can force yourself, but the spontaneous flame will not come that way. So try to be yourself. Don't try to be a Buddha. So I will say something that is not very Zen, maybe, but I don't think that sitting is the cream of the cream for spiritual development. Sometimes it gets very amazing names like King Samadhi, to be seated, and some people view it as an end on itself, in itself, sitting. But from my own experience, I can be sitting and have a perfect sit. Cross leg, chin in, open chest, and all that. And be rehearsing in my mind, or rehashing, and cultivating sits that won't lead me to liberation, but to more clinging, more aversion. So what Sharon Salzberg says here is not only the what, but also the how and the why. Yeah? And recent research in meditation has also discovered that depending on the intention that the practitioners have, they will have results are in accordance with that. Like if people start practicing meditation for stress relief, they will get stress relief. If they practice meditation to have less pain, they will end up having less pain. If people practice meditation to to connect to a broader sense of meaning in life, they will get that. And for me, if I didn't have an intention, I think I could not practice. And sometimes that is something that sometimes is a bit misunderstood when it is said often that we have to sit without purpose. And we were talking about this a little bit with Cliff, sharing about our pre-meditation routines that we discovered that we had. Like, for me, remembering Buddha Dharma Sangha, or thinking the six paramitas and saying to myself, I won't waste any moment in this seat to cultivate my capacity for awakening for the benefit of all beings, which in Tibetan Buddhism is called bodhicitta. The intention to awaken for the benefit of all. So I guess when it is often said that we should sit without goals, I think that's a skillful teaching to counteract the tendency to grasp at goals. Maybe also in an analogous way, when the teaching emphasizes non-self, it's just because we need to counteract the tendency to grasp at the self. But the Buddha never taught non-self. He taught there's not separate self. But he was very careful in not going to the extreme that he called, or well, the translation called nihilism, which is thinking there's nothing out there, in there, and out there. And the other extreme is eternalism. There is a soul, there is an Atman. So he taught about emptiness of self, meaning that we don't have a separate existence, not that we don't have a self. I want to have a self. I hope you all have a healthy self that allows you to explore the flexibility and transparency of the self. So that's the intention. Intention orients not only my sitting, my practice, but also orients my life around a certain objectives or core values. And that I have them, it doesn't mean that I have to be attached to them. I can hold my beliefs lightly. Like I can hold my sense of self lightly without saying, no, I don't have self, or I reject myself. And the other part is the how we do that, and what's the attitude that I bring to practice. What's the attitude that I bring in my sitting practice? What's the attitude that I bring to my relational practice when we find each other outside, when we talk, when we walk, when we live just life? And I think that warmth, tenderness, caring, and compassion is the how that allows whatever it is there that is blocked to start melting and flowing. And it could be your experience too, but one way that I can see what's my attitude, the how that I'm bringing to practice, I can sense that in the tone of the voice that speaks inside my mind. How do I bring my mind back to the present moment when I notice that I'm lost in a train of thought, for instance, in sitting meditation? What's the tone of that voice that says, you're lost, or come back? Sometimes it's a reminiscence of an angry father that is punishing. So sometimes it's very harsh and critical. So the attitude, the how, is all something to be practiced too. So I would think these three elements: the attention practice, which is what we're doing, bringing mindfulness to daily life and to our sitting, and knowing where is our mind in what we are doing, is one aspect of the practice. So other aspect is where I'm going with this. Why am I doing this? Which has the power to organize and bring coherence to different aspects of my life. My sitting, but beyond my sitting, my relationship with my partner, my work, my friendships, what I read, what I do. And the third aspect is the how, or the attitude. How am I dealing with this attentional practice and with this intention? Am I imposing it with a certain aggression? Am I being understanding to myself? Patient? And I don't know, I think that I feel there is something very authentic that lives around here that doesn't deal very well with impositions. Impositions, does that exist? Mm-hmm. There's something very fragile and sensitive. Maybe someone with a poetic sensitivity would say the inner child or something like that. Something very wild and pure and innocent that is hanging in there, that is connected to true nature and true love, that doesn't take very well when ideas are imposed. Sometimes this authentic part doesn't want to hear another sutra or bow to another Buddha or sit for 40 minutes or wake up at 5. And I think if there's not a certain openness in the mind and heart to address that tender part of ourselves with gentleness, the path will turn into a long bypass. Without any hope of integrating part of ourselves that are lost and forgotten in here. So maybe I will close with a couple of questions and see what arises for you from hearing these questions. These are questions that have been useful for me to think about this stuff. Do my beliefs and points of view help me develop my mind and heart, helping me become more loving and tolerant toward others, or they make me more close to others? Do I respond with curiosity and openness when somebody expresses beliefs that are different to mine? What's my reaction when I find someone that doesn't share my same points of view or beliefs? Do my beliefs support my direct experience of awakening my mind and heart, or are they a substitute of direct experience? Have I lost faith over the years in my own capacity to awaken and conform to the Buddhist ideas and end up just believing in Buddha nature, in emptiness? How am I using my knowledge of the Buddha Dharma? And finally, are my points of view about spirituality, are they in the service of reinforcing my ego, or are they really helping me to transcend my ego? And I think I will close with that and open the space for commentaries or reflections. Greg?
So, in the interest of full disclosure, probably I should tell everyone that Gonzalo and I are neighbors. In fact, our rooms are right next to each other. And I want to publicly thank him because from time to time I have these wild all-night parties. He has never once complained. And I've never invited him.
Yeah. That's the part that concerns me the most.
So, you mentioned that neuroscientists have said that people can have as many as 50,000 thoughts in a day. If I look at myself, I would say I get 50,000 thoughts before breakfast. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the day is still ahead of me. But what really concerns me right now at my age, which is almost 75, is death. And I would really like to be as naked as possible when that comes. And over time, I've discovered that, at least my best understanding of myself at this time in my life, is that the areas that resist becoming naked most stubbornly are my shadow material. And I have become very concerned with that, and really regret my previous naivety in my life. And I like you, was raised in the Catholic tradition, mm-hmm. and did the, you know, First Communion and Confirmation, mm-hmm. and Confession and all that sort of thing, and then eventually realized that the whole thing was kind of phony, and except for the mystics, of course. And So then I got involved in Buddhism, and then I had a very naive view of meditation, because I thought, okay, meditation is it, you know. And if I want to get naked, you know, meditation is the place. But then that didn't work so well. At least, or maybe my meditation was insincere. I don't know. But I've become rather skeptical of meditation as I know it and as I practice it, and perhaps it's entirely in me. But what concerns me is there is this deep, dark part in me that meditation just seems to skate over. And I look at the tradition or the practice for other tools. And in the monastic practice, in the traditional monastic practice, they had this monthly congregation of the monks. And then the monks would one by one tell the Sangha, the other monks, you know, their transgressions of the precepts that they had done and so forth. It was like kind of an open confession as far as I can see. And I've never really participated in something like that. I don't know how well it would work, or if it would, even if it would be appropriate. Well, I was just hoping that maybe you had something. I really admire your insight, and I know you've trained in this area of psychology and so forth. And, you know, dealing outside, is psychotherapy the only way to really directly deal with shadow material?
What a beautiful comment, Greg. Thanks for your sincerity. I appreciate it enormously. I think it's necessary, or it's more fruitful to see meditation as an amazing tool for awakening that can really help people with normal suffering, with neurotic suffering like we all have. When there are deeper layers of suffering like trauma or heavy addictions, domestic violence, the meditation alone usually won't be miraculous around those. It's not the function of meditation. Meditation is a technology for exploring experience, but not for for healing those kind of wounds. I don't think that psychotherapy is the only way to go, because psychotherapy is pretty young. Like, as we know it, it doesn't have more than 110 years. And of course, there have been human communities that have dealt with that stuff before psychotherapy came into the picture. But something is needed beyond sitting on your own, in your silence. And I think it's very interesting that you brought up the aspect of confession, because especially coming from a Christian tradition, when we move to other traditions, one of the reliefs is not to have to go to the confessionary, you know? Because we're supposed now to be our own confessionary in front of the world, because everything gets transparently clear right there. Delusion. Confession is a human need across traditions, across cultures. Confession and conflict resolution practices. I mentioned Thich Nhat Hanh, and when I was there, every 2 weeks we would have community gathering, and we would have a ritual that is called beginning anew. So everyone has had the opportunity to begin anew every 14 days. And there's a specific way that you do this, especially for solving community problems. So that someone would have a problem with someone else and we would gather for a beginning anew. So that way you keep the record clean in a way. And I think we really need that. Otherwise, you know, it's like the monster underneath the bed or in the closet. Like, I have this big, dark, black thing that really, if you in a relationship with trust, if you open up, you will notice that the monster is like, not only that it's smaller than you think, but it's shared by so many others. And that is such a relief. Come on, humanity. We're just all together in the same boat. We have very similar dramas. We have very similar parties. John.
Thank you. Someone that I respect from my university days pointed out that it's possible that Martin Luther is the one who sort of set into motion the idea of that Freud was a product of Luther, because Luther stripped out a lot of the ritual of the Catholic Church, including confession. And so Freud had to sort of take up the idea of dealing with the psyche, because I thought that was an interesting point.
It is. I mean, it will come up in different shapes and forms everywhere, because it's just a human need. We need technologies to deal with that. I live in the Peruvian Amazon, and there are the shamans and there are the plant rituals. I live in southern Chile, and the Mapuches have their own rituals in nature to deal with this stuff. But also, community technologies are very important to have in place to digest those things. But psychotherapy is a pretty accessible technology for us in this country, in this part of the state, especially. It's, I mean, underneath each rock there is a psychotherapist.
Small ones.
Yeah, small, yeah. You can put them in your ear. So I think it's a great idea to have some sessions, too. I mean, I have benefited enormously times of my life having a therapist, and probably many of you have. And in that space of trust and intimacy and deep dialogue, I have been able to see and feel liberated of things that I just couldn't just by sitting.
I'm Russell. I know some Indian names. That was such a beautiful that helped so much to listen to you. I thought I have to say something to be part of the. So I have three things. I'm very organized. Well, the first thing is part of what you're saying reminded me a little bit of the idea of constantly falling over, breaking down against a background of balance, I guess, and I somehow that seemed to fit a little bit when you were talking about, you know, you find these new things, they seem really a wonderful philosophy, it helps you so much, and then suddenly you realize that you've become attached to it, and you become a Buddhist, and that isn't actually consistent with what you thought you would, you know, that you've now become something. So, I don't know, somehow that, I get some analogy, some help in that analogy of kind of continually falling over, or, you know, you're building something up, learning something, and then it breaks, and it falls over, but that's, you know, but nevertheless, that isn't becoming unbalanced, and it's sort of, that's one. The second thing I was going to say is, there was already a lot of chirping going on during our meditation today, and there was one moment where I felt that we almost all started laughing. I know that you did, and I almost followed you when we heard the children. Was that a It was a game, but it reminded me of rock, paper, stone, but apparently it involves Dharma and Buddha.
It's fantastic.
So suppose we had all started laughing. Well, I don't know, would that have been meditating? Would that have been sitting, or would that have been going up? You know, maybe is that what you mean, where sitting is not, I mean, if we could have embraced that as part of our sitting. Okay, somewhat incomplete thoughts. And then the third thing is, I guess I'll put this in my own senses. I think that I should not worry about death. A lot of people talk about it because it will never come, I realize. It's not actually something that will happen to me, and the reason is because, well, if there's reincarnation, then I won't really die, I'll go on with that. And if there isn't, if it's just nothingness, or if you just disappear, then you won't experience that either. The only thing that you really have to worry about is, you know, the same thing you're worrying about right now, which is just, you know, how are you going to deal with what's going on now? I mean, this idea of death is something that that's what we see people die, but that's, you know, so that's what death is actually not. It's the experience of watching other people disappear from your life, or but as far as for ourselves, for myself, it's not going to ever happen, actually. That's the way I see it. Because I won't be able to, there won't be anything to experience there. I'll never experience it. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We could have the rest of the afternoon just by commenting your three thoughts. But about the kids laughing or playing, and there's another teaching of the Buddha, and I won't be long in this, but he taught about the seven factors of awakening in several texts, and mindfulness and concentration and energy are some of them, but he also including those factors, which means that without them you forget about enlightenment, forget about awakening. He put joy that we can understand as really rejoicing in life, like take it easy too, or lightheartedness. It's kind of the contrary to negative self-talk. Lightheartedness. And the other is relaxation. And there's something about the Zen tradition that it's hard to remember those factors. Maybe because we are Westerners and so much of the Zen tradition is brought with the Japanese samurai archetype, that warrior, serious, sit forever, don't move, stick. That we think we run the risk sometimes of losing touch with joy and relaxation. It's so important. And kids are huge teachers of that. I think we have to go for lunch.